Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, today we're looking at food from several angles. If you've ever eaten because you're bored, anxious, or stressed at work, and I know I have done that, all three of them, you know that food issues are not about being hungry. Blending insights from psychology, neurobiology, and the study of motivation, psychologist and self-coaching expert, Dr. Joseph Luciani joins me in the second half of today's show for Thin From Within. First, though, we have we're going to talk about American foodie, taste, art, and the cultural revolution. In today's world of excess, a good portion of the world has taken food to a whole new level. Far from looking at it as just nutrition, people now look at it to define art, to define personality, authenticity, their expression, their creative expression. And in American Foodie, Taste, Art, and the Cultural Revolution, food expert and sommelier Dwight Furrow examines the contemporary fascination with food and culinary arts as an expression of control, authenticity, and creation. Let me tell you a little bit about him. I actually sat down with him a couple of weeks ago, and we had a conversation. We're going to bring that to you for the first time today. He is actually a professor of philosophy at San Diego Mesa College. He writes on the philosophy of food and wine, ethics, political philosophy, and aesthetics. And he's a columnist for the Sommelier Insight and a contributor to Three Quarks Daily, a blog dedicated to science, history, the art, and philosophy. And we're going to bring that interview to you right now. Again, the book is American Foodie, Taste, Art, and the Cultural Revolution. And my guest, Dwight Furrow. Before we discuss what you call taste, art, and the cultural revolution in American foodie, let's begin with how your fascination began. And I read that your love affair with food began at the age of 19 when you were invited to an Italian family meal. Tell us what sparked that love of food for you.
Yes, that was kind of a revelation. My family, of course, an old New England family, we ate, but we didn't take that much interest in food, or the pleasure you can get from food. So when I was invited to this Italian meal, I was just fascinated with how much attention they paid to every dish and talking about it endlessly and, over, of course, many, many hours. And so that kind of triggered my interest in food, and it just kind of went from there. Ever since then, I've been very interested in it.
And so the book is called American Foodie, Taste, Art, and the Cultural Revolution. You specialize as a professor in the philosophy of food and wine, aesthetics, and ethics. What's at the heart of what you're trying to convey or open people up to see through your teachings around this?
Well, the main message is that if we become more thoughtful about our food, not only will we get more pleasure from it, but we can also take back our sense of taste from the food corporations that have owned it for decades.
That would be nice. So let's go there, since you went there. At the end of your book, you talk about the paradigm of production and stepping away from this mass production and from everything being homogenized. And tell us a little bit about your thoughts around that.
Yes, well, I think, the industrial food system has been good in some ways. To its credit, it's figured out how to produce inexpensive food in great quantities and to transport it around the globe, but it tends to be unhealthy and it doesn't taste very good. If you've ever tasted a tomato right out of the garden, it's much different than what you get at the supermarket. So if we want fresh local food that caters to individual tastes, I doubt that you're going to get it through large food corporations. We have to eat locally and prepare our food at home and just pay more attention to it.
You say in the book that it's not enough just to eat nutritious food that's, you know, that's at a low cost. We have to have that quality there. So what are you talking about with the quality? Because it's much more than just the quality of the produce.
Yes, it's about the quality of the taste sensations and so on. I mean, the most important thing we can do to lead meaningful lives, I think, is to make each moment count. And there's a lot of satisfaction to be gained by taking everyday matters like eating and transforming them into something special. Food, because we have to eat and eat several times a day, it's the most accessible way of doing this. So why not try to get the most out of it?
Right. Let's talk a little bit about authenticity. We began our conversation by talking about how your love of food was sparked by this Italian meal and everything. You say as far as food is concerned, there are two definitions for the word authentic or authenticity. Talk to us about that, if you would.
Yeah, so usually by authentic, this is a sort of a buzzword in the food world. Everybody claims their food is authentic. And if we mean by that a historically accurate origin, I mean, it's very hard to determine. Even very traditional foods have been made in very different ways. Different families have had different recipes, and it's really hard to know what counts as a authentic version of a dish. So it's a kind of academic exercise to try to discover what that original version of a dish is, but it's not really very practical. So what I argue in the book is that we should define authenticity differently. It really means just being true to yourself, not copying somebody else's way. It's not about conforming to an origin, but rather a commitment to showing continuity within a tradition and just attending to the larger aesthetic potential of a work or a dish.
Mm-hmm.
So I think cooking is authentic if the cooks or the chefs have gone to the trouble to learn the techniques and flavor profiles that constitute the tradition they're working in, and so they can view changes as a organic development of that tradition.
And so what do you think, because we do have a mass foodie craze. I'm always getting invited to foodie events, which I love because I love food, good food. But what do you think sparked this foodie craze? Because it's everywhere. It's on television. People have web shows. People have blogs. I mean, what do you think generated this craze?
Well, I think it started a long time ago. It's been a kind of evolution. It started, I think, in the 1950s and 1960s. One thing that really helped it was the fact that Americans started to travel a lot more to other countries. And of course, other countries have had long food traditions, much more focus on food than we did. So I think all that travel helped. But gradually we just became interested in taste. We see it, I think, we've come to see it as a way of really enhancing our everyday lives, and increasingly people see food as a way of becoming more creative and just making their lives more enjoyable. So it's been a gradual evolution through many, many decades.
Right, right. And of course, artisanal foods are locally produced, typically in limited quantities. You say they're most likely to be authentic. And you talk about Starbucks in the book, and this was funny to imagine that at one point Starbucks was actually an artisanal coffee shop.
That's right.
It's far from that now. And you say that a friend of yours asked you, should we fall out of love with Starbucks simply because they've grown so huge? And your answer, in short, was yes. Tell us more about that thinking.
Well, I mean, they have become they have really done an awful lot for coffee drinkers in the United States, because prior to Starbucks, it was very hard to find a good cup of coffee. So I really admire them as a company. But they've gotten so huge now. When you go into Starbucks, you know exactly what you're going to get, and there's really nothing terribly innovative about it or new. You're not going to get new taste sensations there. And they're not really relying on local producers or so I'd much rather go to a micro roaster to get my coffee if I have that option. Of course, in Seattle, you have all kinds of micro roasters there that do a great job.
Right, we do. Oh, the whole of the Northwest is full of them. It's great. It's really awesome. Yeah. So we're going to take a very quick break. We will be right back. My guest's book is American Foodie, Taste, Art, and the Cultural Revolution. And my guest is Dwight Furrow. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
All right, everybody in the car, let's go.
What are we going to do first when we get there, Mom? Go for a hike?
Sure.
What about canoeing? Can we go canoeing, too?
I don't see why.
How long does it take to get to the forest?
It's not that far, sweetie.
Are we there yet?
Yep, we're here.
Already?
It's a short drive from your neighborhood to your naturehood. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a neighborhood park or green space near you. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the U.S. Forest Service.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, speaker and friendship expert Shasta Nelson provides the blueprint for nurturing sincere, intimate friendships. And Wendy Paris offers tips on how to avoid dueling lawyers and acrimony in the divorce court in her new book, Splitopia, Dispatches from Today's Good Divorce. Tune in Monday at noon Pacific time right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m. and catch up with podcasts at conversationslive.com.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Write it down, shout it loud. Alternative Talk 1150 AM. Now, wasn't that fun?
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and my guest is Dwight Furrow. He is a professor of philosophy at the San Diego Mesa College, and we're talking today about his new book, American Foodie, Taste, Art, and the Cultural Revolution. And so, Dwight, did I read somewhere that you are actually a sommelier?
Yes, I've also done some sommelier work. I have a couple of wine certifications.
And I know that you're a columnist for the Sommelier Insight and Three Corks Daily. You like to write about this. So before we dive back into the book, I just wonder if you'd tell us, when you're reviewing wine, what you look for.
The main thing I look for is, does it meet certain quality standards? So a really good wine should have a lot of intensity. It should just jump out of the glass. It should have a lot of complexity and should have good structure, meaning that it should have good acidity and robust tannins on the finish. So that's the main thing I'm looking for. Then above and beyond that, you're looking for whether it has an elegant evolution and how striking or original the flavor notes are, and so on.
And so tell me what an elegant evolution would look like. What kind of evolution would it have?
Well, it should evolve on the palate. I mean, the really great wines, as you're drinking them, they evolve. Usually you'll have a burst of fruit up front, and then the acidity kicks in, and you get that really mouth-watering sensation. Different flavors emerging, and then finally on the finish, you get the dry, and if it's a red wine, you get the drying sensations from the tannins and so on, and more development of the flavors on the palate. So that's what I mean by an evolution. It should also evolve in the glass over the course of an evening. Really good wines change from the time they're open until they're given more aeration. So there's a lot of different dimensions of evolution that a wine goes through, and I look for all of that when I'm evaluating a wine.
Right, right. And as I said, I know you blog on this. You also blog on aspects to do with your book and the work that you're doing there. Why you say that food bloggers are at the heart of the food revolution? Why do you say that?
Well, I think that if you buy cookbooks and so on, a lot of them involve very complicated recipes with very difficult techniques. Especially if you're buying cookbooks from the celebrity chefs and so on. Food bloggers are dedicated amateurs, and they don't necessarily have the training of restaurant chefs. So their approach to cooking is more down to earth, and I think more accessible to home cooks. So I think food bloggers translate what chefs are up into something that home cooks can accomplish.
Right. So do you cook yourself?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
And are you what, chef status? How do you describe your level there?
No, I'm not a chef. I'm not trained at all. I just learned myself. So I just think of myself as a good home cook.
There you go. That's good. One of the things you talk about is mindful eating, and I want to talk a little about that, because you say it's not just about weight loss. You know, if you go to some of the major franchises that help people lose weight, one of the things they talk about consistently across the board is mindful eating. Tell us what you mean about that from your perspective.
Okay. Mindful eating just generally is the practice of putting aside all distracting thoughts while you eat and just focusing intently on the food and its flavors. And as you mentioned, it's often touted as a way of helping people lose weight without having to diet. But for me, it's a way of gaining a genuine appreciation of food. If we slow down and really savor food, we get much, much more pleasure from it. And we notice things that we ordinarily pass over in our haste. There's really an amazing amount of subtlety in food flavors if we learn to concentrate on them. It also gives us the opportunity to develop our own taste preferences rather than those that are imposed on us by the food industry. So when we take the time to prepare our own food and then fully appreciate it by eating mindfully, we gain more control over our lives.
Right. And so what would you say is the main benefit of mindful eating?
The main benefit is just you get more enjoyment from your food. You're really appreciating all the flavors the food has to offer. And so that's the main benefit, I think.
Mm-hmm. And so tell our listeners who you wrote this book for. Usually when somebody's writing, they have a specific audience in mind.
Well, I had two audiences, really. One was foodies, people who are really into food. I wrote the book because I thought there was not a lot of sort of intellectual discussion of food out there. And so I thought food is pretty important to us, and we've kind of gone food crazy, as you mentioned, in the United States in recent years. So it was important to have more discussion of why that is and what it means. So one audience is just people who love food. I do like to read about it. The other audience, in the background, I don't focus on this all that much, but in the background there is this discussion in philosophy, in aesthetics, about whether food is an art or not. And so I also have that whole conversation in the back of my mind while I'm writing the book as well.
Yeah, I think, do you have a blog on that?
Yes, my blog is called Edible Arts. The URL is foodandwineaesthetics.com.
Right, I remember taking a look at that now. I just couldn't remember the name of it. It's very interesting. Let's go back to something we touched on a little earlier. You described the home and the role of food as important pleasures and also expression of human freedom. How do we start to incorporate that in our life on a daily basis? Because so many people, you know, do go through fast food, make fast food choices because they're so busy today.
Right. So you have to begin by looking at what you do that's just habitual. You just kind of do it over and over again without thinking. And then start to think about, you know, do I really want to do this? Is there a better way of doing it? It starts with, you know, how you shop, really. Looking for the best ingredients, and then, how you plan your meals, leaving time in order to cook as much time as you can, and as I said before, to eat mindfully, to think about what you're eating, and so on. So it's really about just becoming more reflective about it, realizing that if you're doing something according to habit, you're not really in control over it, and so trying to make everything more purposeful. purposeful and deliberate.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I read, I believe this was on a blog post, you said mindful eating requires an awareness of food, of where food comes from, the historical context in which we consume it, and attention to how we can use this awareness to enhance future experience. And then you said many people might think this is overthinking our food. So respond to that, if you would.
Well, like I said before, there's a lot of pleasure you can get from the food by thinking more about it and by paying more attention to the subtleties of it. It's not really just about, it's not just a sensory experience. There's a kind of intellectual dimension to it as well. All of us are eating and cooking within food traditions, and the more we can understand that tradition and where our food comes from and so on, the more we can enjoy it, the more we can compare flavors and compare dishes and understand their relationship.
Right. And you did a lot of research for this book. It does have an intellectual aspect to it. You do argue several points throughout the book. So what did you learn yourself that surprised you? What surprised you the most when you were working on this?
All the discussion about mindful eating, when I started the book, it was sort of implicit in what I did, but when I got into the research, I became much more fascinated by that whole process, and so I did a lot of reading on it and so on. So I think that came about as the result of actually beginning to write the book.
Okay. And what would you like our listeners to take away from today's conversation?
Well, the main message is if we become more thoughtful about our food, not only do we get more pleasure from it, but we can take back our taste, as I said before, from the food corporations that have owned it for decades. Make your own taste your own.
I'm all for that. And I know people can find out more about you at foodandwineaesthetics.com. And what was your other URL again? Give us that one too.
It's called Edible Arts is the name of the blog.
Okay, thank you. And the book is called American Foodie Tastes, Art, and the Cultural Revolution. Dwight Farrow, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Publishers Weekly said about Dwight's book, you don't have to be a fan of sophisticated food to enjoy this often entertaining, illuminating lecture on America's current taste revolution. The book again, American Foodie, by Dwight Farrow. Please do stay with us. We will be right back. We're going to be talking about Thin From Within with Dr. Joseph Luciani.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services, if you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Dr. Nels Rasmussen at NelsHealingMinistry.com, we cover the world of animals. This Sunday, April 3rd, it's Shelter, Rescue, Sanctuary, and Anything That Helps Our Animal Friends Sunday. We'll have a great lineup of interviews with several local shelters, lots of good news about animals, some special features, and an update from the Ananda Institute of Living Yoga. Join us for Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, speaker and friendship expert Shasta Nelson provides the blueprint for nurturing sincere, intimate friendships. And Wendy Paris offers tips on how to avoid dueling lawyers and acrimony in the divorce court in her new book, Splitopia, Dispatches from Today's Good Divorce. Tune in Monday at noon Pacific time right here on Alternative Talk 1150 AM and catch up with podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Real people, real life, real radio. Really. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. We are talking food today from several different angles. And my next guest is Dr. Joseph J. Luciani. He is the author of Self-Coaching and the Power of Self-Coaching. And he's a practicing clinical psychologist. He's an in-demand speaker and expert on these issues. He's been on many, many media outlets, including MSNBC, CNBC, Discovery Channel, NPR, etc. The list is long. And he's written a new book called Thin From Within, The Powerful Self-Coaching Program for Permanent Weight Loss. And this book blends insights from psychology, neurobiology, and the study of motivation. So I would like to welcome the author of this, psychologist Dr. Joseph Luciani, and the book is called Thin From Within. Welcome, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
And you go by Dr. Joe, so we'll be calling you Dr. Joe for the purposes of our show today.
I've been called worse. That's great.
And I want to begin, Dr. Joe, if we can, by beginning with the two reasons that you wrote the book. You said the first had to do with curiosity, and the second was because you wanted to share what you've learned about your emotional struggle with food. So let's begin with the first one, if we can.
Well, the first, curiosity, it occurred to me that we tend to be so disciplined in so many other ways in our life other than food. I've seen people run marathons with big, huge bellies. I've seen people that were able to just go to the gym every day and just when it comes to food, just be brought to their knees. So I was curious as to why food and eating, even when it goes against our best intentions, why is it that that's the discipline that we seem to struggle most with? And so I wanted to delve into this both with my patients. And out of curiosity, I wanted to understand more about self-discipline, or as we might say, the lack of self-discipline that seems to prevail when it comes to dieting and weight loss. The second reason had to do, I was never really overweight per se, but I did develop a slight heart blockage. And I was given the option of invasive stents or change my diet radically. I chose the latter, and I went to a very strict, rigorous vegan diet, and also in the process gave up most wheat products because of triglycerides. So I went through a very tumultuous period where food became the enemy. Going to a restaurant was just something that was rather depressing, and I had to deal with those cravings and those old habits that were really hounding me. But I was curious about that as well. I wanted to know, well, what does this tell me about both food, my relationship with food, my dependency on food, and what can I do about it? And that was the genesis of really thinking about taking, because typically I'd been writing about anxiety, depression, relationship, and I wanted to move now to an area now which really I felt I had some very firsthand experience with. And that was with food, weight loss, and what I call weight mastery.
Right. And a lot of people eat emotionally because they are anxious and they are depressed, all of those things that you focused on before. You have done extremely well putting together a series of programs on self-coaching. What is it about self-coaching that that motivates you to do this kind of work?
Well, what initially started me was just the realization that therapy itself was maybe 50% of why people tend to feel better about themselves and their problems. And the other 50% had a lot to do with motivation. And as a therapist, just sitting back and just reflecting wasn't enough. So I wanted to combine a kind of spirited exchange where one could really be motivated and coached to fight the good fight. Because with life, It's often not about learning. It's really putting that learning into action and to motivate and get someone to really decide to do what's necessary to change habits. That requires a different mindset, and people are reluctant to change. I mean, let's face it, change always has some resistance and some anxiety connected to it. So I felt that I needed to come up with something that would, just like a coach on the sideline of a ball game, to really get somebody in that fight, to get them out there to really overcome the hesitations that keep them from the life they want.
Right.
So that was the genesis of the self-coaching model, which has followed me through all my books. And with eating, it certainly is a fundamentally important, because the key to permanent weight loss is, of course, the motivation. With any diet, with any attempt to lose weight, if we lose the motivation, then we've pretty much lost the battle.
Right. So why, I mean, you devote a whole chapter to this, so I know this isn't, you know, you can only give us a quick answer here, but why is it so hard to say no? Is it purely just habit?
Well, we are creatures of habit, and there are a few reasons why it's so hard to say no. It's what I call habit resistance. We tend to, from our earliest days with food, we tend to develop a kind of peculiar relationship with food. We no longer use food to fuel our bodies. I mean, back in Stone Age days, when Fred and Wilma Flintstone were foraging around, you know, a few berries or some roots and tubers would be enough to satisfy them and set off the appropriate amount of pleasure chemicals in the brain. But, you know, nowadays with the scientifically engineered hyperpalatable foods, we don't stand a chance. Our brains are flooded with the feel-good chemicals that really make us want to go back again and again for that toxic food. So it's very important to understand that with food, we are up against the chemical aspect or the addictive compulsive aspect of food, as well as our general nature to resist change. We were all born to avoid pain and seek pleasure, and we have come to use food as our vehicle for pleasuring our minds, not our bodies. And that's the key. We're not feeding our bodies anymore. We're feeding our minds.
Right. Well, there's a great quote in the book by Miss Piggy: never eat more than you can lift. I just love that quote. But you just mentioned it begins in the mind. So let's look at that, because there's biology going on there, and it plays into it quite a little bit. So you say, you call it mind tasting. You say it's not just mental. Talk to us about mind tasting, if you would.
I would say that mind tasting is probably the most significant part of my book. When you see a picture, when you are walking in a mall and you smell the aroma of Cinnabon, did you just smell it when I mentioned it?
Yes, I pictured it too, with extra topping.
What happens is that this isn't a passive process. Our bodies are actually changing according to the mental image that we are receiving in our brains. And when that happens, things start to happen in our body. Saliva increases, gastric acid, insulin, blood sugar, fatty acids. All these things are a result of mind tasting. Now, mind tasting, if left unchecked, will lead one direction, and that's right to the pantry. So mind tasting is very, very critical in this whole battle of weight loss and really weight mastery, because once you see, we have a certain consciousness that we bring to our attempts to lose weight, and that comes from our intention to diet, and whatever your diet is. This book is not about a diet. It's not a diet book. It's to be used with any diet of your choice. So you bring your good intentions forward and you say, I am only going to stick with this plan. Well, that's great, but you have to realize that when you're passing by that Cinnabon stand or a piece of chocolate cake or a brownie, what happens is that just below the surface comes these thoughts that now fill our brain with the mind tasting. And the door gets cracked open ajar a bit, and what comes through that door are the impulses that create the physiological changes that now create a compulsive, yearning longing. Once that happens, then those intentions that we first started out with get somewhat submerged, And then if we linger, and here's the key, if we linger with mind tasting, not only do those intentions get submerged, but they really get defeated,
mm-hmm.
and we lose that battle.
Right.
So one of the really big keys is when you start to realize you're tasting that food, that the sooner you nip that in the bud, the better your chances of pulling away.
Right. I've noticed, you know, if I sit down to watch television, it's usually fairly late at night, and Top Chef is a show that I like to watch, and I've noticed that drives me to the kitchen. So I've stopped doing that now. I watch it on demand earlier in the day.
Well, if I may interrupt, it's such a very important concept that we miss quite often. We often say things like, it made me want to eat, or she made me go
right.
to the pantry. She got me so upset. Things, people, places, they don't make us eat. We
right.
make us eat.
Right.
And so you're, and I know you didn't mean this, but basically it's really about taking responsibility for our eating and
right.
our lives.
Right. Well, I take my, you know, dog goes everywhere with me. We go to the bank through the drive-through. He knows they feed him cookies. And they say, oh, your dog's so patient sitting there. But when I look around, there's drool about 6 inches long hanging from his mouth waiting for that cookie. So he's conditioned. It's conditioning.
We tend to drool as well in different ways. You know, we tend to savor, you know, that's the going back to the mind tasting. We start to savor these thoughts. And in a sense, we're promoting that saliva and drooling, just like pooch.
Right, right. You talk about creating an enemy checklist, and you talk about the tipping point, why it's important for us to recognize what leads us to our tipping point. So I wonder if you'd talk a little about that.
In the field of epidemiology, the tipping point is a point where a virus or a disease cannot be controlled. When it comes to eating, it's the point where you either capitulate or walk away from the tempting food. But what's important is what leads up to that tipping point, and that's the period of ambivalence. This is where mind tasting is going on. This is where the devil is on one shoulder and the angel on the other, and it should I, it shouldn't I. And this battle is so significant, and it's so important. What people need to understand is that, you know, just because you're being sabotaged by these feelings, it ain't over until it's over. Until the point where that fork reaches your mouth, you are still capable of walking away. So we're really talking about, you know, getting knee-deep in our typical compulsions and urges, but getting out of the muck and mire, even though you're knee-deep in it. So it's really recognizing that you always have a chance to incorporate various strategies, to fight the good fight, to really resist. And until that fork reaches your mouth, you should not be handing yourself over that easily.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it's important how we fortify ourselves, how we start to develop that, I call it a self-discipline muscle, because it's really important to recognize that if you've struggled with weight, and there was a study done in England where by the age of 45, the average woman has been on 61 diets.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's just incredible that we tend to just go down that yo-yo highway again and again and again. And we're not learning anything because, you know, we tend to put all our stock in the diet and we say, well, this diet's going to be the miracle thing that I've been looking for. But sure, you may lose a few pounds, but 80% of people who lose the weight put it back right on within 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we may be temporarily losing weight, but we're not changing us. And unless you change your mindset, your habits, unless you change you, you're going to be one of those 80%ers.
So what might be a self-coaching tip when we're in that state and we're starting to go down that rabbit hole where we're going to reach that tipping point of putting the food into our mouth? What might be a self-coaching tip for us to stop that happening?
Well, the first thing I have a technique in the book. I call it self-talk. And the first step in self-talk is to separate facts from fiction. So you really need to stay conscious, you see, because the urges and compulsions are always trying to drag us. I love your rabbit hole image. They're kind of drag us into that rabbit hole. And so being conscious we've heard the term now being used quite a bit, mindfulness. Being mindful and conscious of our intentions is very important, because once we allow ourselves to become somewhat clouded from those intentions, we're in danger. So separating fact from fiction is to not be dragged into rationalization. Oh, I'll just start my diet tomorrow, or I'll start exercising in a week. Not to be dragged into self-deception or even faulty feelings, because people say, oh, I feel so hungry. Feelings aren't facts. Very important that we recognize so many ways that we tend to deceive ourselves. I call it mind games. And we play these mind games all the time. It's like going to a supermarket and just saying, well, I'm just going for a loaf of bread. And that's not what you come out with. You know, you really let yourself, or standing in front of the fridge and saying, now, what do I feel like eating tonight? That's a real dead end right there.
Right. Yes. I know the feeling myself, running for a carton of milk and come out with all kinds of stuff I didn't need or want. So let's talk about, you talk about three adverse situations and say it's important to create your enemy checklist so that we're aware of this, we're being mindful of it. Let's go to break so I don't have to interrupt you while you're talking about that. And we'll just take a quick break here. The book we're talking about today is Thin From Within, the Powerful Self-Coaching Program for Permanent Weight Loss. My guest, Dr. Joseph J. Luciani, and he's also the author of Self-Coaching and the Power of Self-Coaching. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and we'll be right back.
I can taste it in my mouth. It's just so bittersweet. It's right there in your eyes, of apple green. It should be easy, but it's hard to leave.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can. Should have worn my glasses. So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
On the Launchpad this week, Dr. Ellington will be joining us to tell us about a program she created to empower the lives of young women. And Martha Pekinnick will be sharing how her Purposeful Purses project has made an impact in our community. Plus, we'll get a boost with Chef Dina's key ingredient. Jimmy Baca will inspire us with a quote of the week. And R. Hill reports about events that are on the horizon. Have a blast every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on Alternative Talk 1150 a.m. Catch up with podcasts on thelaunchpad.club.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has a new Facebook page, so you can see what's happening on our show and what we're up to between shows. Like us on Facebook and look out for upcoming contest drawings.
This is Alternative Talk 1150. Got it? Cool.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. If you've ever struggled with food, with eating issues, if you've ever eaten just because you're bored or you're stressed at work or you're feeling alone or you're depressed or anxious, don't miss the rest of this segment. My guest has written a book called Thin From Within, the Powerful Self-Coaching Program for Permanent Weight Loss. And my guest is Dr. Joseph J. Luciani. He's a psychologist. And I asked you before the break if we could talk about the three big enemies, as you call them, Dr. Joe, adverse circumstances, harmful emotions, and destructive habits. So let's look at our enemy checklist there so we know what we're dealing with.
Okay, well, when I talk about the enemy checklist, it's very important to when you sit down to eat, or when when that thought goes through our mind, I'm hungry. You know, we have to challenge that. Let's find out what's driving the hunger, because physiological hunger is very different from psychological hunger. With psychological hunger, we're feeding the mind, or we're anesthetizing ourselves from the stress and duress of life. So it's very important to know your enemies, as Sun Tzu said, to know your enemies. And when it comes to food, it's certainly applicable. So we have, let's start with the stressful circumstances, a bad day at work, an argument with a neighbor, difficulty with the kids. Stress is not an innocuous, of course, emotion. And stress is something that we want to try to quell as quickly as possible. So food, of course, comes to mind when we're stressed, because it does tend to sedate us. It does tend to release dopamine, which is the pleasure chemical in the brain, and we tend to feel better. So stressful circumstances will certainly conspire to almost knee-jerk reflexively get you thinking about, well, what will make me feel better, and certainly food comes to mind. That goes also for harmful emotions. Same kind of emotions can create stress, depression, anxiety, boredom. People don't realize that boredom is an emotion. Mm-hmm. And when we are bored, stressed, anxious, depressed, we are also wanting to do something to sedate ourselves, to anesthetize ourselves. And again, food becomes the go-to vehicle for just excusing us from the duress of our lives. These enemies are very important to understand, because when you're in the cloud of a compulsion or an urge, or just destructive eating in general, when you realize what's driving it, you stand a much better chance of keeping those intentions foremost and keeping those intentions conscious. And the third, of course, is habit. As we've mentioned earlier, we are creatures of habit, and so many habits, when just talking about emotions, when we're depressed, we tend to eat. We sit in front of a TV and we put our plate in front of us. We reach into a bag of chips, and before we know it, the bag is empty. We are creatures of habit, and habits, by their very nature, can exist just below the level of consciousness. So when you are not aware of your habits, or any of the enemies for that premise, of course, then you are most susceptible to eating destructively and feeding the mind, not the body.
Right. It really is all about paying much more attention to what we're doing, isn't it? And just not going on that train trip.
but that's exactly it, because basically what happens when we get hypnotized and seduced by the feelings of wanting certain foods, what happens is that those feelings are very powerful, and they will cloud and fog the desire or intention to lose weight or to eat appropriately. So we're up against some powerful biological, psychological influences that really are, if we do nothing and if we don't insist on an active, not a passive, but an active mindset, then you are going to fall prey. Now, this is during the transitional period when you're losing weight and when you're going to weight mastery. In time, we actually retrain the brain, and this is not a fictional thing. We actually change the structure of our brain. So eventually what happens, and we call this neuroplasticity, we're actually changing our habits. I call it habit reformation. At this point, we're no longer struggling. It's my own struggle I've had with changing my diet to this very strict vegan diet of mine, that in time it becomes effortless. And I know people don't realize that, because typically we don't go the distance by just dieting. But if you change your lifestyle and you learn to really do the things that are necessary to maintain the restructuring of your habits, then it really isn't a matter of struggle. And, that's a wonderful thing when all of a sudden you can sit and see somebody eating a piece of a Dutch, I don't know, what's your favorite dessert? Mine might be dark chocolate cake or something. And to just really say, it would taste good, but you know what, I don't need it. Without any emotional regret, without any feelings of victimization, that's the place you get to when you can really retrain your brain to see food differently and to experience it differently.
Right. Right, right. And that's why I think this book is so great, because you look at the psychological aspects and you look at the biological aspects. And I think, at least for me, if I understand what's going on physically in my body and, you know, why this chemical may be kicking off, it helps me to counteract it. And you talk about dopamine, you know, it's something that is stimulated by most street drugs out there. So it's a pretty powerful weapon, isn't it, really?
Yeah, people don't realize that it is the same pleasure center of cocaine, of heroin. I mean, food is powerful. And food, when we think about it, food are chemicals, and they break down in our body the same way that other chemicals do. So, yes, we are up against a flooding of various chemicals that that really resist change. And I would say that it's all about responsibility, you know. I call it mind over mouth. And if we don't take responsibility, then we're eating like children, impulsively. That's how children eat. A six-year-old child isn't going to weigh the pros and cons. They just want that ice cream cone.
Right.
So when we eat like children, then, of course, this is the loop that we get ourselves into. We're not realizing the adult mature perspective, which requires gritting of the teeth a bit, but taking that mature responsibility really is staying consistent with our true intention.
Yes.
And that's really what life should be about. It goes far beyond just food as well.
Yes. Yes. Well, you say in the book, the bleak reality is that, while many people can lose weight, more than 80% of people who diet will gain that weight back. We spend more than $30 billion each year on gym memberships, diet books and diet plans, etc., etc. But so many people, and I've done this myself, have said, they get to a certain point and they're doing well and people start to acknowledge, hey, you're looking great, you know, and you start feeling great, and then they self-sabotage. What's going on there? Why do we do that? How can we stop it?
Think of a rubber band. As we diet and we go through the stress of dieting, the rubber band begins to stress. Now, you're going through some withdrawal. You're eating and staying on your diet, but the rubber band is getting stretched. There comes a point where the rubber band snaps back, and that's where maybe you've had that slip, or maybe you've just lost the intention or motivation. So unless you go the distance, you see, losing most diets will help you lose weight. There's no misunderstanding there. Diets do work, but you see, unless you can go beyond the point where that rubber band snaps back, then you really haven't accomplished fundamentally anything because you haven't changed. So it's so important to realize that it's not really a matter of losing weight. It's the keeping it off. That's really the key. And if you think in terms of what's the next miracle diet, there are over 70,000 diet books on Amazon.
Wow.
I mean, they can't all be, just faulty. I mean, everyone has something to say about it.
Right.
And they all do something. But you know what? The truth is, no diet in the world is going to give you the life you want and the figure you want and the fitness you want, unless you decide that it's up to you to really go the distance.
Right. Well, the book is packed full of self-coaching tips, inspirational advice, psychological, neurobiological information. What do you want listeners to take away from this?
Well, again, to me, the fundamental essence of this whole book is the concept I mentioned earlier of mind over mouth. I think that once you realize that there is no alternative to lifelong weight mastery except retraining your mind and your brain, unless you're willing to do that, then accept the fact that you're going to be on that yo-yo highway again and again and again. At least be realistic, at least be honest with yourself. But if you want a life of fitness and if you want to lose that weight forever, then at least recognize that there are going to have to be some fundamental changes, and you're going to have to learn to fight the good fight. Hopefully my book can help motivate someone to realize just how to do that.
Yes, I told you before we came on air, you wrote this book just for me, but I'm sure millions of people are benefiting from it. So thank you very much, Dr. Joe. I appreciate it.
Well, you're quite welcome. Thank you.
And I know listeners can find out more about Dr. Joe and his work at self-coaching.net. Self-coaching.net. And my guest, Dr. Joseph J. Luciani, of course, psychologist and self-coaching expert. His book, Thin From Within, The Powerful Self-Coaching Program for Permanent Weight Loss. And I want to thank each of you for tuning in today. If you have any questions or comments on today's show, you can find me at info@conversationslive.net. And you can also find us on the website at conversationslive.net. You can find me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. All right, that's it for this week. We'll be back next week. Next week, we're talking all about relationships. We're talking about beginning, keeping and nurturing, and ending relationships with dignity and grace. We'll see you then. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.